Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, those of you who've lived in Chapel Hill for some time, if you mention the record bar, it brings up all kinds of memories. It brings up memories of a lifestyle that's just a little bit different from what it is today, of the time when music brought us together and the music stores were the places where we gathered, and the people who ran those music stores, the record shops, were our guides into the music of the day. Legendary, legendary people in Chapel Hill are Barry and Arlene Bergman, who were the powers behind the behind the wonderful feeling that we got about the record bar in Chapel Hill and the explosive growth of the record bar into a 200-store enterprise. So Barry and Arlene are back in Chapel Hill visiting, and I'm here to exploit them by getting them to talk about the old days in Chapel Hill, about the business of the record bar and what happened to it, and then also about the philosophy of business and ethics that have been that are the underpinnings of a new book, Nice Guys Finish First: How to Succeed in Business and Life, a new book by Barry Bergman. And Barry, just in case I forget, it's available on Amazon.com.
It is.
Nice Guys Finish First. Ha. Welcome, Barry.
Nice to be here.
And Arlene's in the studio with us. And so people, there are hundreds of people whom we don't even know right now are saying, golly, I get to know about what Barry's up to now. Want to tell us about your book first?
Yeah, sure. It's an ethical look at business. My experience was you could be a good guy, good person, and do well in business. And if you treat everybody well and you're ethical, that it'll come around to you. And it's worked. It's worked in the record business, and it worked later in the cosmetics business. So I decided to write a book about it.
Well, is that all there is to it? I mean, now you can say that in a paragraph. Why'd you need to do that in a book? Can you just say,
well,
be nice?
Be nice is a good thing, but it's not a well-regarded technique. At least a lot of people think that in business you got to be some kind of tough guy and be nasty to your customers and nasty to you, to the people who work for you. And that's not my experience at all.
Why is in looking at other businesses that you had to deal with, and that you have to deal with as a consultant now, or do you find that more business leaders, successful business leaders, and businesses are run on the basis other than it's important to be nice to the folks who work for you?
Interestingly enough, my experience is that most businesses are run rather well, and they're run by people who are pretty nice to everybody. But there are these few jerks out there who give everybody the wrong opinion of business.
Well, you mention some of these people in your book, and I don't know whether I want to be sure I didn't misunderstand, but I didn't gather that you're a great admirer of the style of Donald Trump.
I think he's got an awful style, and every time I see him on television going, "You're fired," it makes me pretty angry, because I've had to fire some people in my career, and it's a terrible experience, and it's a terrible experience for the person who's doing it, and it's a terrible experience for the person who's getting fired. So I just don't think that's something to make sport of, the way Trump seems to do. And Trump, everybody says Trump's such a great businessman, but here he's in bankruptcy with his casinos for the fourth time. He's bankrupted all kinds of companies. So I would prefer to pattern myself after somebody who's really successful.
Who would be your you established the way that you've run two very successful businesses as a model, and described how you operate, and I'd love to talk about that. But who are the people that you would say, look at their careers in business and follow that pattern, because they're the nice guys who are also tough enough to have a successful business, fair? Who are your idols?
Well, look at the Nordstrom family, for instance, from Seattle, who run Nordstrom's and who still run it. You can go in a Nordstrom store, and you know that the Nordstrom family, you know they're nice, because everybody in that store is wonderful. They love their customers. They're so happy that you're there. They'll do anything for you. So that's the kind of people I want to pattern myself after. Sam Walton, for instance, who started Walmart, was just a wonderful person. His people loved him. Now, I'm not so sure that the people who run that company anymore are exactly like Sam Walton, but he was one of my real heroes.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the record bar as it developed, look, I mean, where's the place to start? Is roughly 1960 a good starting
1963.
Point?
1963. We opened in June 1963 in Chapel
Hill.
Tell us about
your daddy and your family and your and where you were in life when all of this sort of first began to come together.
My father was in wholesale grocery business, and that business eventually went away because the chain stores started buying directly.
Cut out the middlemen.
And during the war, this guy owed him some money and paid him off in jukeboxes in Burlington. So he had this jukebox route in Burlington, and they used to
sell. These were not jukebox in the warehouse. They were jukeboxes restaurants and
exactly.
places where people
exactly.
gathered. Exactly.
And they used to sell the records that came off the jukeboxes out the back door of the warehouse. So it evolved into a record store. It was called Music Land, interestingly enough, in Burlington. And
this was sort of the outlet store for the used records off the jukebox.
And that eventually evolved into a regular record store. And when my father went out of business in the wholesale grocery business, the only thing we had as our family's livelihood was this record store. And I had been working for my uncle in Durham since I was 13 years old, and he had a store called The Record Bar. So when my father had to go over there and run this store in Burlington, I went over with him through high school and college because I was the only one in the family knew anything about the music business.
So you'd learned from your uncle who had drifted into the record business from another way.
After World War II. He came to Durham and opened a record store.
And so he was, what would you say, fairly successful? And you learned about that business under him?
Then I learned a lot from him.
Then your dad, I don't want to take anything away from your dad, but your dad didn't know anything about the record business.
No, but he knew how to sell things. He knew how to merchandise, coming from the wholesale grocery business.
Even to retail customers.
Yeah.
And what were those? Gosh, I'm sorry, I'm getting off track
now,
but what were his secrets about selling?
Well, the way you display and also the way you treat people. My father was great at customer service, just terrific. And I learned a lot about what I know about customer service from him.
I'm trying to get back.
Okay.
This is 1963.
Yeah.
This is the changing times where the generation gap was maybe as great as it ever was in America. Here's your dad who knows everything about how to sell, but nothing about records. And here you know a lot about records and are learning about, watching about how to treat customers. And so these kids come into the record store that your daddy, he wants to serve them, but he's got a problem relating to them.
He didn't know anything about the music either.
What does he say to a customer?
So
what do you want?
What can I find for you? And we learned fairly early on that you don't say, can I help you? Because everybody then says, just looking. So you'd say, hello, how you doing? How's the weather? Anything.
Contact. That's a lesson that nobody seems to have learned yet.
Not many people.
But that's a good,
So you try to make contact with a customer. And you try to engage them rather
So your
than,
dad knew this.
Yeah.
He
yeah,
knew this
yeah.
rule.
He taught me a lot.
And so he would come talk to him and find out, get him to the point where he would know what he might suggest. But then he didn't know what to suggest because he didn't know about the music.
Well, he learned. Uh-huh. It doesn't take long. You can learn about the business.
All right. So what was, did you aspire, when did you start saying, well, maybe I'd like to get my daddy, I'd love my daddy to stay around, but I'd like to be in charge.
Well, I went to the other school, the one over there, 8 miles
it, but
away.
But you've got a dark blue sweater.
Yeah, right. But I'm a born again Carolina fan. I promise. I was screaming and yelling a couple of weeks ago. Let me tell you. So, and when I got out of school, I was heading for New York because I wanted to go to work for one of the major record companies. And my father says there's a great opportunity in Chapel Hill. We ought to open a store over there. And I said, okay, I'll tell you what, I'll do it for 5 years, but then I'm going to head for New York.
And what was in the back of your mind about what you wanted to do with the record companies and why you thought you could be successful there?
I wanted to be around the music. That's where I wanted to be.
I just tell you that we're talking with Barry Bergman, and we're talking about his new book, Nice Guys Finish First, which summarizes what he's learned in a career of successful business and a little bit about his life. Now, I don't want to accuse you of anything out of school or anything, but you do love celebrities.
I do.
And so was that you've also, as you, anybody who reads the book will find out, you've met a lot of celebrities. And that was what you sort of said, I'll be up around where these guys are
I wanted to be around the people who made the music. I always idolized anybody who could make music. because I didn't have any talent myself. I was a bad trumpet player in the junior high school band. So I knew I couldn't do it.
I was a cornet player, but yeah, the same thing. It was just third. The highest level I reached was third cornet in the junior high
band. I think I was way. I was further back than that.
But so you wanted to do the music. So your dad's invitation to run a new store, the Record Bar, in Chapel Hill in about 1963.
June of 63.
You come to Chapel Hill, and do you open the store?
Arlene and I.
So you're now...
my wife.
We got married
and opened the store. And Arlene's parents owned this deli around the corner named Harry's. So it was good. I had a place to eat lunch every day.
Well, somebody was confused because I'm going to get off track.
No.
You just got to forgive me because when I was talking
about
Piston with you guys, from reading the book, I knew that your dad had been in the wholesale grocery business. And they said, no. Delicatessen, best delicatessen ever.
That was Arlene's father.
So that was Arlene's dad.
Yeah, his name was Harry, too. Both our fathers were named Harry.
Wow. Okay, well... I don't have enough background to pursue this, so we got to go back. So you've found a Chapel Hill girl to marry.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
Absolutely. So I'm from Durham originally. I was born in Durham.
So you settled into Chapel Hill open?
Opened a store.
Tell us about Chapel Hill and what you found and what you learned as you opened the store, about the students, the townspeople.
We had a real competitor to start with. His name was Kemp Nye, who was a legend in Chapel Hill.
I tell you what, we got to take a
character.
Break. Got to take a break because that was, again, when I talked about other people, I didn't know where this question was going, but they said, hey, ask him about Kemp Nye. And so I didn't have to ask you, but we'll take a break.
Okay.
We're talking to Barry Bergman about the Record Bar and about some of the experience that he summarized in his brand new book, Nice Guys Finish First. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Barry Bergman. Barry, as anybody who's lived in Chapel Hill longer than I will know, that Barry and Arlene are famous in Chapel Hill. They are the powers behind the Record Bar chain and, more importantly, the Record Bar store in Chapel Hill, which opened about 1963. And when I interrupted you, you were telling me that you had a competitor named Kemp Nye.
Kemp was a character, but he was selling about as many records as anybody in the South, south of maybe Philadelphia or south of maybe Washington. He sold about as much music as anybody, and he was well known, but he was this wild guy, and he sold things too cheaply, and he was always in money trouble, but he was a character, and he was tough competition. But a lot of times, he didn't have the hit records, and when we opened, for instance, he never had Bob Dylan, and Bob Dylan was just starting to be a huge artist then, and the business started to evolve. And
so let me interrupt you again.
Sure.
I really do apologize for this, but in the sense Kemp was a little bit older, closer to your dad's age, is that right, than you?
Closer to my father's age, yeah.
He was he had the business, and it was serviceable, but it was not new and based on new trends.
And a lot of it was based on classical music, too. He really liked to sell classical music.
So when you and Arlene said, well, gosh, what are we going to do to exploit this opening? What did you say? Did you focus on the competition? Did you focus on your customer, or what did you do?
I believe in running the best store you can run. We couldn't focus on him because I didn't want to get into a price war with him. The markup in the record business is not very good anyway, never has been. So we tried to run our show the best we could, and we concentrated on rock and roll and folk music, which was a big deal at the time because that's the stuff I really liked. I like classical music too, but rock and roll was obviously where it was going.
Now you and Arlene are you both managing the store, or is Arlene going back to help her dad in the deli?
She was still in school, and she was coming in to help as much as she could, and I was running the store.
And what are the economics of opening this? Did your dad's other stores support you, or
We closed the store in Burlington and moved it to Chapel Hill. We didn't have enough money for another store. My father, in the interim, had bought my uncle's store in Burlington, so we still had my uncle's store in Durham.
Uh-huh.
So we had the store in Durham and the store
and
in Chapel Hill.
Did your uncle then kind of retire, or did
my uncle eventually, he moved to Jacksonville, Florida, and opened a chain down there called the Record Bar. Also, he had four stores, and eventually our company bought those stores.
Wow. Yeah. So, again, I'm trying to put myself on Franklin Street in 1963, and this is a dramatic time.
The times they were a changing, and in Christmas week 1963, the Beatles released "I Want to Hold Your Hand" in the United States. The first week in January 1964, Meet the Beatles were released, and our business changed overnight. We had people literally waiting in line outside our store to buy Beatles music.
Golly, it was, and are you making money on these, these sales? Like what you said, that the markup is not very great. What is it about?
It was 62%. 62% cost of goods.
And then whatever you can get above that towards the established prices.
Yeah, but you really, it's a very close business because it was always a commodities business, basically. Everybody had the same music at about the same prices. If you sold it too cheaply, you didn't do well.
And would you just say that you were just fortunate to have come into the business at the time the Beatles came?
Right place at the right time. It was absolute luck. We certainly didn't know about the Beatles.
In other times, he must have stocked the Beatles records too. I mean,
He couldn't get them because he was, as I say, he was always in money trouble. He was such a wild guy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we had an opportunity. We had a real niche in a great market.
What were the other popular, just to remind us, what else was going on in 1960s?
Elvis Presley.
60s? So Elvis was selling.
Elvis still was big. Yeah, yeah. And a lot of folk music. Peter, Paul, Mary, Joan Baez.
And what were people buying? Were they just buying 45s? Was this the main driver?
Primarily it was 45s. And then it started to evolve into an LP business.
And who were your customers?
The customers were obviously the kids in Chapel Hill, plus people who lived here.
The students then...
And professors. We had a decent classical business because of mostly professors.
All right. Well, now the story doesn't end here. You guys are happy. You're making money with the record bar. You ought to be just satisfied and fall into the Chapel Hill. Here, I've got a good business. I'm going to enjoy the life. But you weren't satisfied.
And we had a front row seat to the 60s in Chapel Hill, too, which was pretty wild. It was an amazing thing to watch. But 5 years later, as I had told my father, I said, either we expand now or I'm going to New York because I don't want to be a record store manager for the rest of my life.
So you've been doing this for 5 years, all during this transformative time in our country during the from 63 to 68. And as you and your dad discuss these, what are the pros of expanding and what were his reservations or the negatives or the risk of expanding? What was he worried about?
My mother was very worried that we would overexpand, and we were doing well in both stores, and she was really concerned that we would push ourselves too far and we were going to have a person from outside our family probably over at the register, and that's always a concern in family businesses. But I figured I wanted to do it, and it was obvious that Raleigh was a great market for us to go into.
So had you Raleigh your first?
Yes.
So who'd you get to help you, and how'd you do it?
Well, I went over and opened the store originally, and Arlene stayed in Chapel Hill and ran that store, but eventually we got a store manager over there, a guy named Phil Geiger, who used to work at the station a long, long time ago.
Well. And ultimately you had a manager in
Raleigh.
In Chapel Hill, too,
In Chapel Hill, too. Yeah, we started putting in managers as we started to expand.
There have been some very beloved managers.
Oh, yeah, lots.
Can you remember who these guys are? I'm going way back.
Yeah,
all right.
We did a record bar reunion a few years ago, and we had about 350 people show up for the reunion.
So did the ball start rolling and it just became cutter that you opened new branches?
We tried to find a store on Hillsborough Street, across from State, couldn't find one. So we ended up going in North Hills when they enclosed it, became a mall, which was a new trend in the country then, and we were very few of them. And we did more business in North Hills the first day that we were open, this is 1968, than we'd ever done in either of the other stores in a day. So we said, maybe malls are a good place to sell records. And the fourth store was Cameron Village. And we started doubling every year. It just, I don't know. When I look back on it, it doesn't sound like it was reasonable to do it. And it used to drive the banks crazy because we were doing it all. We didn't have any money. We were doing
so
it all
you're
bank.
Borrowing money to do
oh, yeah,
to,
oh, yeah.
to open
it was all,
the
all bank borrowing.
And now you wound up with more than 200.
Yeah.
So not every. Not every attempt is a home run. I mean, you must have had some
pop-up
flies.
There were some bad stores.
Talk about Give us, you know, this is not part of your book. Your book's not about failure. Your book's about success. But take us through a failure of and why, or just in general, what were the mistakes that you made, and then how'd you correct them?
With us, it was pretty much about real estate. If we could put a store in the right place, it would do well. We knew how to sell records, but we went into a mall one time in Louisville, Kentucky, and it was a terrible mall. It was too small. It was too old. And I never went over to see it because I don't think I would ever let us go in it. But my real estate guy was. Real estate people are always pushing you. Take this one, and they'll give us this one. You know, so we opened this place in Louisville, and apparently it was in a bad part of that mall, and we did no business. I mean, none.
You know. And then you just have to close it quick.
Oh, yeah,
is that,
sure. Here.
That what you do.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we're visiting with Barry Bergman. We're supposed to be talking about his new book about business ethics, Nice Guys Finish First, How to Succeed in Business and Life. And Barry, I'm exploiting you by learning about a time that's important to us in Chapel Hill, and that was the time when the record bar was king. Barry and I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Barry Bergman is my guest. Many of you all will know Barry better than I. Barry and Arlene Bergman are famous characters in the history of Chapel Hill. I'm sure that one day there's going to be, in the Chapel Hill Museum, there'll be a whole full floor exhibit about the record bar and the Bergmans.
I hope so.
And we're trying to get a little bit of a fix on that through the vehicle of a book that Barry has written about his business life and some of the lessons from his success with the record bar, with another fabulous cosmetic business that I hope we'll get a chance to talk about, and then in terms of things that he's learning as he consults with other people in business today. If I just reminisce with you, we're not going to talk about your book, so let's just talk about your book for a minute.
Okay.
And the lessons that you've learned and that you talk about that. If I got a criticism of your book, it's just that you've got the summary of the book on the cover, which is that nice guys can operate in business. But it's not as easy as that. And I want to talk about maybe one of the hardest things. You mentioned that you never liked to lay people off if you could possibly help it. It just wasn't fair. On the other hand, you're adamant. You've been critical of Donald Trump for firing people. But if there was a hard-nosed bone in your body, as it was revealed in your book, you say if somebody needs to be fired, you got to fire them right away, and you got to do it surgically. You take off this nice guy stuff because the nice guy stuff can lead to them hanging around for a while. And if there was a mean bone in your body, I would say you're just as bad as Trump when it comes to firing.
Well, look. Laying people off and firing people are two very different things. Laying people off to me means people who are performing and they're doing well, and then all of a sudden they don't have a job. Firing somebody meant that they weren't suited for our company. It wasn't good for them, and it wasn't good for us. I know that sounds like a rationalization, but it's true. And a lot of people went on to have good careers in other places after they left us. So I think they're very different. And When I had to fire somebody, I hated it. I hated the experience because I knew it was changing their life too. So I had real empathy for them.
Well, one of the things you'd fire people who had worked in your business, who had been successful at the appropriate level, and then they got into a level where they couldn't perform, and instead of getting them back to where they belonged, you just fire them.
Well, I just didn't think that you could take people and demote them, and then they would, because you took everything away from them. So the Peter principle, in fact, does work.
You another angle or a corollary to the Peter principle.
Yeah, my experience was that companies and organizations grow past people who remain in the same position, and that's a terrible thing. But we were a company that had explosive growth, so there would be people who would be competent at one level, maybe at 20 stores, but weren't competent at 50 stores. And that was a very sad thing. And that happened a few times, too.
Well, this is, you may just jump all over me about this. But, I mean, that principle which you elucidate, that's a word that's, I hope I used it right. But the rule that sometimes in successful businesses, people who are successful at when the business was small are not successful as it grows. And that business, as we've watched and learned, say with these high-tech enterprises, that you have a young person who is very successful in the entrepreneurial stage but needs help later on. And at one point in your business, I think you said, I need to get somebody else in charge of my business because I may be great at starting the businesses but not at running them. And what did you learn? Tell us about that and tell us what you learned.
I did it twice. I got talked into it the first time by a consultant who I ended up hiring as a chief operating officer, who turned out to be a disaster. And then another time I got bored, so I thought it'd be fun to bring in somebody. So I brought in a psychologist, and that was a disaster too. So
why did you do this?
I don't know, because I thought it might be fun to watch what he'd do with the company.
So you, for the first time, you took a consultant who you brought in, like you're a consultant now,
and you said, hey,
sounds like you know all the answers. Come run this for me, and I'll support you.
He had me convinced that I couldn't do it at a larger level.
So the consultant convinced you that you weren't adequate, and then kind of like a Dick Cheney selection as vice president. So none of these other guys can do it. You can't do it. So select me, and I'll keep you out of trouble.
Please don't compare me to Dick Cheney.
Well, no, I was comparing your backup, the consultant. No, I was comparing you to Bush. That's even worse, isn't it?
Right.
Well. That's a lesson that you're just painfully honest in describing that situation as a part of what you learned in business. But I'm not sure what the lesson was for people who are in business now who are asking the question.
Well,
could I get somebody else to run this business and get out of the way, or should I stay in there because I care more about the business than anybody else?
The lesson is experience pays off. As I experienced all these things, I got smarter and smarter and better at doing things. The other part of that is, and where I really got to at the end before we sold the company, the first company, was that I got really good at choosing people. So that when we sold the company, I had a chief operating officer who was wonderful, and he and I were a great operating team. And he ran the business on the day-to-day, and I was the visionary, which is what I do well anyway.
I think that was where I came down on the lesson, that if you're a visionary but not an operating person, if you can find the real operating person who's willing to work under the circumstances that you ultimately are in charge, but that you trust him, that kind of partnership often works very well.
It'll work great. If you let that person do what they do. That's the key thing. Give them parameters, agree on goals, and say, see ya.
Well, one of the saddest parts of the book was not sad in terms of cashing in and all that, but tell us about the decision that you made to sell the Record Bar business. Now, we think of the Record Bar in Chapel Hill as one store, but it was 200 stores, and it was, in general, a thriving business.
It was doing very well.
What year are we talking about?
1989. Which proved to be a very good year to sell a record chain for a number of things. And W.H. Smith, a British company, showed up and wanted to buy us. W.H. Smith owns a lot of the airport stores in the United States. And they were big in the music business in the U.K. They had owned about 25%. They owned Virgin Records in the U.K., among other things. And they wanted to buy us. And then a Belgian company called Super Club showed up, and they wanted to buy us, and they got in a fight, and they bid the thing up to levels that we thought were ridiculous. They made us an offer we couldn't refuse.
So you sold. You're a young man. You're 47 years old. And you're rich. All of a sudden, rich and don't have to worry about anything. There are two sort of angles to the story. The first is, then what happened to the Record Bar? You got to report to us. That's not a happy story.
It's not a happy story. The people that bought us, the Belgian company, they were called Super Club, and we often called them Stupid Club. It didn't take them long to pretty well ruin our company, which they did. A lot of our stores stayed around. It went through, I think it's in its sixth different hands of a company now. But they all sort of went away. And, of course, now the music business in this country is going away anyway.
I often wondered as I read your book, and then as I've watched record stores, great American institutions
tower.
Sort of disappear because of technology. Have you ever thought back and said if we'd kept the record bar, and that there wasn't an opportunity to sell it, that we had to keep it? What would you have done? How would you have managed as the transformation in the way we deliver music to consumers changed?
I hope I would have gotten into the technology business. I hope I would have been able to evolve it into something other than what we were doing. But I, at this point, I'm darned if I know what that would have been. I don't know.
Sort of like the guys in charge of newspapers today. They know they got to do something different, but they don't know exactly what it would be.
They're getting online, but can they monetize online?
Yeah. All right. Well, you weren't burdened with making that decision, you did have to decide what to do with all this money and what to do with you and Arlene had to decide what to do with the rest of your life. So. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and find out the answer to that question. Visiting with Barry Birdman. Barry is well known. He and his wife Arlene in Chapel Hill, associated with the Record Bar, and he's telling us that story. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Chapel Hill. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Barry Birdman. Barry has written a book called "Nice Guys Finish First: How to Succeed in Business and in Life." And the book is a combination memoir, I'll tell you what this is. This is Randy Pouch's The Last Lecture. This is what I'd like. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I know exactly.
This is what I've learned. Might not be right for you, but I've lived a long life, and here's what I've learned.
Worked for me.
This is your last lecture.
Yeah.
Well,
I hope so.
Or unless there's a sequel to the book. Or the next to the last lecture. But what we talked about, this is the thing that intrigues me, and this, I think, is of interest to those of us in Chapel who've watched other people other than Barry and Arlene, who've come in and come from modest circumstances and through energy, entrepreneurialism, meeting a need, some luck, just cashed in, gotten rich, and it's a mixed blessing, I guess, at least for me. You'd rather be rich than poor, but nevertheless, to be young, have a lot of money, and out of the business, was that totally a blessing, or were there
I was going to miss the music, and I knew I was going to miss it, and I started a record company for about a year for the people. Using the money of the people who had bought Record Bar, and that didn't work out. They pulled the funding, and just a few months after that, this friend of mine, his name is John Hansen, he wanted to do something entrepreneurial. He was a Harvard B School guy, Harvard Law School, but he wanted to do an entrepreneurial thing, and he wanted to do it in the Bay Area, around San Francisco. So I said, okay, go find something, and I'll back you. So he found this little cosmetics company. It had four stores and a bankruptcy, and they were sort of patterned after the Body Shop. And
it doesn't sound good. This is four stores, the business is in bankruptcy, and you got a good friend whose business judgment you trust, but he ain't got any money, and and that's the partnership.
That's the partnership.
That's crazy. That'll never work. That's what I would have done.
I trusted him because I really liked him, and I believe that one person can make a huge difference. And the name of the company was Bear Essentials. So we bought it, and I was teaching him how to run something, how to sell things, because I know how to do that. I didn't know anything about cosmetics, but I did know one thing. The cost of goods in the cosmetics business is 28%. I saw that, and I said, if we can sell any of this stuff, we can make a lot of money.
So you're like your daddy was with respect to the record business. You're a good salesman. You don't know anything about this business, but you do know how to deal with people.
Yeah, I did understand the fundamental of the business, which is you were selling conditional okayness to women. You were selling Saturday night. In other words, if I use this stuff, I'm going to be cool on Saturday night.
I didn't even thought of that. Yeah. And so how do you transfer that lesson into the operation of the business?
It's a marketing business. Okay.
At the level of the store or the advertising level out in the...
Both places. And in the store, what we decided to do was do a lot of makeovers. Women would come in, we would show them how to use the product, and they would
common
look...
Common now, but that was sort of new in the...
Yeah, it was fairly new.
Come in,
yeah.
We'll fix you up, yeah. We'll see what you can do, and then hopefully you'll come back and buy... Or you buy something right now, you'll like the products that we put
on. And we opened a few stores, and we did okay. And then about 7 years into it, my partner decided he wanted to go run a public company in San Diego. So we were looking around for a CEO, and we had a woman in place. Her name's Leslie Blodgett, and she was the merchandiser for the company. And I said, okay, how about you run the company? And she said, she was a brand manager from Neutrogena.
This is the place where I would have said, this is crazy. You're making a bad decision.
Yeah, right.
And so how did it turn out?
And what I thought, I knew she knew how to sell cosmetics. So I said, I tell you what, I'll teach you how to run a company. So I was her consultant. I used to talk to her for an hour or so every day, how to run the thing. And she knew how to sell cosmetics.
Let me just say again, although this was beyond the 60s, this was still a time where men our age had not developed yet a complete confidence in women as business leaders. I mean, we got proved absolutely wrong about that. But you must have had to say, hey, I'm putting a woman in charge of... I mean, it's a cosmetic business, of course, but nevertheless, you were out there.
Well, first of all, I had a model. My entire business career, my partner was my wife, okay? The second thing was at Record Bar, we had more women in top management than we had men.
You'd already learned this.
Oh, yeah, I already knew it. I already knew it. And we could get better women because they didn't bump into the glass ceiling at Record Bar the way they did in other places. So I was totally confident a woman could do it.
And
that never even occurred to me.
And she must have sensed that as well.
I guess. It turns out she's a genius.
I love this story.
She's now become a star.
Well, I want to talk about Mary and Arlene, but you convinced me that we should talk about this woman because she's the source of a great part of your wealth right now.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So
absolutely.
In just a minute or two, tell us about her and why she was so special. What she did. I mean, what had to transform the business.
She started behind the cosmetics counter at Bloomingdale's when she was a kid. She knows how to sell cosmetics. She loves it. And she called me up one night after she'd been running the company for a while and said, I've been having trouble sleeping at night. I've been staying up watching QVC, and I can sell it. I can do that stuff. And I said, they don't do any business. I didn't know. QVC 2 years ago did $6.5 billion. They do a lot. And she went on there, and we sold more product the first half hour than we sold in a store in a year. And we said, might be something to this.
So she was good because she knew. Why was she
because
good on TV?
She understands why women want cosmetics. It's mineral makeup for the most part. She just gets it. And when she goes on QVC, it's like a party. It's like a makeup party. And she works with all these models and the hosts, and they have fun.
So in that instance, the business is transformed from shop-based profits to worldwide airways.
Yeah, it's on the tube. There are people watching all over the country, mostly women. And then she did the same thing again for an infomercial. And we were going to do one of these guest hosts, you know, celebrity hosts. She said, "No, I don't want to do that. I'll do it myself because I can make it work."
She had developed through the success of QVC that she knew that she was good on the air and that she knew the product and that she wasn't going to succeed by training somebody else.
And she cares. She really cares about these women. So when they did the infomercial, they didn't use models. They took regular women off the street and made them over and showed what... And it's a tremendous difference.
Do you send her a Christmas card or a turkey at Christmas time?
I mean, I send her a couple bottles of wine. Yeah, she's wonderful.
Well, Barry, we're about out of time. I'm visiting with Barry Bergman. Barry's got a new book out called Nice Guys Finish First. It's about his business career and the lessons that he applied at the Record Bar and in his other business enterprises of trying to treat people fairly. And it's a great affirmation of a way to do business. Barry, I've taken up all of this grilling you about all this business and stuff, but you've got lots of friends here at Chapel Hill. Is there anything you and Arlene want to say to them while you're here?
I just want to say...
And explain why you're not back here living with us, because people love you here.
Well, we live in Santa Barbara, California, which is about...
It's almost as nice as Chapel Hill.
Almost as nice as Chapel Hill. But Chapel Hill doesn't have an ocean. That's the only difference. And it's just great to be back home in Chapel Hill. It'll always be home to me. So I love it. I love the people here. So how you doing?
Great. Well, we're thrilled to have Barry and Arlene Bergman back in Chapel Hill and grateful to them for sharing a little bit of their time with us and with all of y'all. This is D.G. Martin. I'll be right back here same time tomorrow.